since I mentioned the Garvey Fellowship program, is that Tom was a Garvey Fellow. Was that 1982 or so?
84.
Right.
I was only 8 years old then.
Yeah, that's right.
A child prodigy.
All right. So thank you, Tom. We have time for questions, so anyone who has a question,
Carl
has the mic, and we're just wait a second for him to get that together.
Are we on? Okay. How much of the public health establishment's grab for expanded power do you think is fueled by just petty empire building and personal, you know, desire for power, which can be sort of, well, I always think of the old saw, you know, that you have to have an enemy. Everybody has to have an enemy. And, you know, they got rid of things like smallpox and cholera and things like that. And so they suddenly ran out of diseases and epidemics to prevent. So they go for more things. And how much of that do you think is based on just desire for personal power and glory and the feeling of wanting to, you know, do something wonderful for the world, as opposed to actual deep, like, like a real deep desire to control the world?
Is that for?
Does that make sense? Either whoever wants to.
Well, it strikes me that most of the people who are involved either in the public health field or with any one of these allied movements, like the anti-smoking movement or the anti-fat movement, most of these people are quite sincere. They believe they're doing good. They believe they're doing the Lord's work. They're, in fact, usually puzzled that anybody would criticize them. There's no question that they also have not just an ideological interest, but in many cases a financial interest, a career interest in this field. But of course, that could be said of you know, most people. People want to believe that what is good for them is good for the world. That's a very natural sort of inclination, and it's very easy to convince yourself that what you're doing that is pays well for you is also good for other people. And so we look at something like the tobacco settlement, where all of this money is pouring into state treasuries as a result of the settlement of these lawsuits against the tobacco companies. And some portion of that, not as much as you might think, but some portion of that is going into the anti-smoking movement to fund things like anti-smoking ads and research on tobacco-related illness and so on. So you have this situation where the people who are pushing for these arrangements and pushing for this money are also benefiting from it. But at the same time, you know, it's kind of ironic, because then they're put in a position where if they really succeeded and everybody stopped smoking, well, they'd all be out of work and none of this money would be coming in anymore. So they're in a situation where on the one hand they want to stop people from smoking, but on the other hand, it's really not in their interest to do that. You know, so it's very complicated, and it's, you know, I don't like to attack people's motives. I think most of these people are quite sincere, and there may be other issues of ego and financial reward that come into it, but they I'm sure they've convinced themselves that what they're doing is for the best.
Yes, first a kind of a generic question for both panelists. We started way down a national slippery slope towards the nanny state, and I'd like any thoughts about how we can stop that. How can we actively change or reverse that movement? And then a specific question for Jacob, dealing with the smoking. William Osteen threw out the EPA rulings about secondhand smoke, declared that was the rulings were invalid, yet we have laws all over the country based on that ruling. Why is nothing being done to overturn those laws that restrict secondhand smoking?
Well, the slippery slope, that's a tough question. Maybe I'll relate it to the last question. Is in Washington, I've lived and worked around there for quite a long time, and I've studied Washington, written many books about what goes on there. the culture of Washington is such that if you understand economics, you're an outcast. If you make economic sense, you're an outcast. There's a very, very strong and clearly designed attempt by the Washington establishment to eliminate economic logic from policy discussion. I read the Washington Post every morning, and the hallmark of the Post is economic ignorance with uncritical acceptance of any and all government intervention schemes that are brought out. And I think the same thing happens with public health, that a lot of the things Jacob and I talk about or write about in this issue have to do with the effects on freedom, the effects on the rule of law. Well, that's like economics in Washington, that if you talk about these things, they'll either laugh at you, ignore you, or conduct a campaign of character assassination against you. And so most people will just shut up about it. Even if people are in the public health field, they don't want to be castigated or marginalized. I recall when Bill Niskanen, the chairman of the Cato Institute, made the statement that much of what government does is unconstitutional when he was a member of the President's Council of Economic Advisors. In the front page of the Washington Post, they tried to smear him and destroy his reputation. You know, you just don't say those things in polite company. And so, you know, it's a big battle to get people to appreciate things such as the rule of law and individual liberty. And that's why the Independent Institute is here. And that's why we spend so much of our time addressing these issues. We try to go over the heads of the bureaucrats in other ways, otherwise, and educate the public.
Yeah, I would just add on that question that, you know, a big part of this is trying to get people to think about the principles underlying public policy. And people tend not to think in that way. They tend to think in a very ad hoc way. This measure sounds good, without thinking about, you know, how the principle that underlies that might be extended to other areas you might not like so much. So that's obviously a big part of what we try to do, is try to get people to think of what's the next step down the slippery slope. And, you know, the principles do matter. And even though the anti-smoking activist may be quite sincere when he says, I don't care about cheeseburgers, you know, I'm not going after fat people, other people will come after him and quite explicitly will say, look, let's copy this model, the anti-smoking model. What did they do, and were they successful? How can we get the government to get people to stop, you know, to get off their asses and get some exercise and stop eating so much? And they see the analogy quite clearly. So it's a matter of trying to get people to think about the ideas underlying the policies. And as to the other point, I think the odds of actually getting anti-smoking laws or smoking bans reversed are pretty small. There has been some attempt to introduce the Osteen's decision in towns that are now considering passing these ordinances. I'm not sure how effective that is. I think in Princeton, which was considering an ordinance, they tried to do that, and to point out that, in fact, this EPA report that everybody was relying on had been tossed out by a federal judge. So that may slow things down, and it may have an impact in certain towns. But in a place like California, where, you know, it's an increasingly small minority that still smokes, and the smokers, the people who do smoke, are so cowed, that even they say that let's ban smoking, if you believe the surveys. At least they tell people that's what they think, you know, when they're interviewed. Most people, I mean, this is a tyranny of the majority. I mean, most people want the ban. I just assume not have smoking bars, and I'm sure the vast majority of people feel that way. I'm not willing to force that, you know, solution. But most people, again, don't think about the principle involved. They just think, yeah, well, you know, nobody wants smoke. We bother with smoke. So you get very large majorities who support laws like that, and then it becomes very, very hard to overturn once they get used to the idea they have a right to this, you know, smoke-free environment.
The survey that Jacob is referring to, you may not have heard of, is a new survey that came out on people in bars, what their view is about the smoking ban in bars. The only problem with it is that, of course, most of the dedicated smokers are not going to those bars, and the people who are going to it don't care.
Plus, a lot of the respondents were probably drunk.
Bars. The next thing.
How can you rely on
bars?
Yeah. They're drinking in bars. Yeah.
I really enjoyed your talks. Thank you very much. My name is Mark Volker. First time I've been to one of these meetings, but I think I'll be attending some more of them. My question is, how do you think this is all going to end? When you go into an attorney's office, you see rows and rows of books that contain all the rules that we're all supposed to be obeying at all times. And those rows of books get ever longer and heavier with time. And I don't see them, I don't see that trend reversing.
Is your question addressed to one of the two?
It's not, it's either or both. And my question is, how do you think this will end? Well, when will this trend turn around, and how will it turn around? And are there examples in from history of the trend of ever larger and more powerful governments sort of moderating and turning around without some sort of violent cataclysm or external force that comes in and causes a reversal of this kind of trend? Thanks.
Well, the collapse of communism would be one example of that, I would think.
Has that really caused a deregulation?
There's more freedom than there used to be, certainly. You see it in many other areas, too. Usually things have to get so bad and people get so fed up and disgusted that they force a revolt to happen. Chile was the first country to adopt the social security system. They were also the first country to privatize it after it got so bad, so unproductive, and drained so much capital from their economy. And so that seems to be the trend, that things have to get really bad to wake people up, because I think, you know, Tocqueville's famous saying in Democracy in America, that under a democracy, people tend to be sort of more or less hypnotized, like sheep being led to the slaughter, that your liberties are taken from you a little bit at a time, and over 50 years, you know, they're almost all gone, and at that point we tend to wake up at some point. And I can point to the examples of like the Chilean privatization and other things, even here in the U.S.
Jacob, do you have anything to
say? I just said that in a sense it's fortunate that most of these people are not very deep thinkers and are not consistent, because if they were, you know, consistent, God help us. You know, I mean, it's good that they only have their own little issue that they stick to for the most part. But then on the other hand, it's hard for people to see the larger trend. And people get used to these interventions, things that at one time, you know, were very controversial. It's quite controversial to force people to buckle their seatbelts not so long ago. Now, I think almost every state has a law requiring that. In some cases, they can actually stop you for not wearing seatbelts. In some cases, it's incidental to the stop.
Yeah. Does the federal government bribe the state to make those laws?
Yes.
What's that?
Does
the federal government bribe the state to make those
right.
laws?
With the seatbelt law. Yeah. Well, you get funding.
That's right.
You know, so and things like, you know, smoking in bars, ban on smoking in bars, that was astonishing. Just 5 years ago, 10 years ago. And I wonder what your sense is, that whether there really is has there been a backlash in California against that, or is it that sort of petering out? I think initially there was a lot of disobedience, but it seems like...
There's only a lot of rebellion when it's like freezing and raining out. Yeah. You have to go and stand out in the rain, huddling over in your little jacket.
Well, you know, the initial poll indicated...
What a trade-off.
I think it is important to realize that a lot of these policies that become universals because of federal policies that essentially induce people, and that's the way the seatbelt policies and also the helmet laws and a lot of these others are adopted. But one thing I was going to just say real quickly is that we went through Prohibition, we came out of Prohibition. We also, there's a movement, as I mentioned, for medical marijuana and things like that. Ironically, or not ironically, depending on your perspective, many of the people in favor of legalizing medical marijuana are also the ones pushing for smoking prohibition, and vice versa, too. So, I mean, it's as Jacob's saying, it's this very diffused type of thing. Question right here, Carl?
Yes. You said that smoking is a behavior and not a disease, and of course the anti-smokers will immediately point out or claim that smoking-related disease is communicated by a secondhand smoke. Now, it takes me 1,500 to 2,000 words to refute that credibly. I was wondering if you had any better way of handling it.
Well, you know, I got very bogged down in the science behind this, which I intended to just, you know, touch on, because I realized that there really was some serious misrepresentation going on. But the evidence, there is evidence, but the evidence has been represented as being much stronger than it actually is. And that's interesting. It's interesting how things get distorted, how people misread things, how researchers push their findings as far as they possibly can, and then reporters take them and run even further with them, and so on. And that whole phenomenon is very interesting, and it has implications across a variety of public policy. But when it comes right down to it, it really ought not to matter. You know, whether or not there is a lung cancer risk associated with exposure to secondhand smoke. If there is one, it's very small. It's a trivial risk. But assuming that there is or assuming that there isn't, it really doesn't matter, because the truth is people don't want to be around stuff. Whether they think there's some tiny risk they're going to get lung cancer after being exposed to it for 30 years, or just because it makes them cough and it makes them nauseated and it gives them a headache and makes them sneeze and whatever. They don't want to be around it. And this, I think this obsessing over some hypothetical tiny risk of lung cancer is really just a way of legitimizing that complaint, that people don't like it. They don't want to be around it. And so the question is, what do you do about that? Clearly, a lot of people don't want to be around it. And the response has to be that then you choose to go places where smoking is banned, and you create a demand for that. And then, you know, restaurants and bars and so forth will respond to that. And then they were responding to that well before there were any kinds of laws requiring them to ban smoking. But in a free society, there should be a place where a guy can go and have a beer and smoke a cigarette, if it's okay with the owner of the bar, you know. In California, if, you know, you're a smoker and all your employees are smokers and all your customers are smokers, you still can't, you know, do that. You still can't have a place where they can drink and smoke a cigarette. And I think that should appall people. It's just astonishing that we cannot, in this society, have a place for that kind of disgusting, appalling, you know, choice for people to make. So that's the argument, I think, that needs to be pushed, because if you get into the science, then there's a lot of back and forth about it, and most of the people just sort of tune it out. The truth is that you just have to face up to the fact that there is a big demand out there for smoke-free environments. There are a lot of people who are annoyed by it, and the less they're exposed to it, the more annoyed they get by it, you know. The fact that you very rarely encounter it nowadays, especially in a place like California, means that when you do encounter it, you get even more upset. So you have to do something about that complaint, address it in some way, that people will find plausible and persuasive of it.
Thank you.
Dr. Gold,
I'm Lois Gold, and I work in the field of cancer prevention. There's something in the loop that's wrong here. I can't put my finger on it. We all watched movies, those of us who are older, movie stars smoking, and we weren't bothered by smoke in a bar. It's only when it became clear that it was a communicable disease, if you will, analogy, because of the secondhand smoke claims, that people cross the line from voluntary risk for a smoker to involuntary risk for a person in the bar who didn't smoke. Once people accepted that data, then I think it became clear that it was the model of malaria or measles or something. So I think, in my mind, the secondhand smoke belief in its hazard for cancer or lung disease of any kind is what's pushed people to be in favor of that legislation. I think they're afraid for their own selves, whereas the smoker is increasingly viewed as a victim who's addicted.
Yeah, the response to the idea that this is, a risk that is being imposed upon you voluntarily, that it's not. I mean, that people can choose where they go and where they work, and that's one of the factors you take into account. I understand that, I mean, people may be genuinely worried about it, especially if they've seen some of the more exaggerated claims.
Yes.
But it still seems to me that, that's not really the main issue. I mean, this is...
Oh, I think it is, because
I mean, I don't see a difference in kind between something that really that causes, you know, has the potential to cause health damage in the long term, and something that simply, you know, causes short-term health effects that are unpleasant. There's a difference in kind, maybe. I mean, a difference in degree.
Well, the idea is you can't predict what's going to happen to you in the long term. If you had an acute effect, I mean, you'd know it, and you could leave the bar.
Yeah. The question is, I mean, do people really believe that if they go to a bar a couple times a week, they're going to get lung cancer? I'm not sure.
I think they have an increased risk. And in point of fact, in the field I work in, you know, if you're going to ban DDT because of its presumed carcinogenic effect in humans, the data is zero. And for secondhand smoke, there's at least a little epidemiologic data. So there's a continuum there on the level of evidence.
I think the crucial point then it comes back to the issue of, is it voluntary exposure or involuntary? Is it consent is the issue. That's the difference between secondhand smoke and, say, pollution that's given off by a factory or dumped into a river, is that people can choose whether or not they encounter it. And increasingly, they're choosing not to encounter it. So that you have to come back to that in order to you know, explain why it should be allowed in some places. It's going to be up to the
trial. I've read quite a bit about the history of this whole thing. I mean, not as much as Jacob has, but there was a conscious decision by the anti-smoking movement because they recognized that most Americans are tolerant people, and they'll say, "Well, I'll just go to the no smoking section if I don't like smoke." How can we overcome this, they said. So they said, we have to convince people that secondhand smoke causes cancer.
Right.
So they came to the conclusion first, and then the government funded all these studies, which, as Jacob points out in his book, are very, very weak scientific grounds. The point I would make is that the point is made in my book, Cancer Scam, is that whenever the government enters into a public policy debate, it has the ability to drown out all other voices. And this, all this research and the PR about the so-called research is funded with tax dollars. And so I think that's how this came about, this belief on the part of the public that secondhand smoke is dangerous. You know, everybody knows that now. Of course, the scientists have proved it, but it's doubtful.
But you're saying what I'm trying to say.
But it was the public relations campaign funded by the government that persuaded the public that this is real, even though the research is real weak at this.
Well, I mean, I think, I don't want to give the wrong impression. I think it played a very important role in the propaganda in the sense of saying this isn't just, they're not just killing themselves, this is a cost they're imposing on you, in the same way that the argument about costs imposed on taxpayers because of publicly funded health care says it's not just their business, they're hurting you too. They're hurting you in the pocketbook. I think that's very powerful rhetorically. And when you get images like you do in California that you know, have you seen this billboard? I'm not sure if they have it up anymore, that shows the woman standing next to a man, you know, nicely dressed, but like from some old movie. The man says, mind if I smoke? And she says, care if I die?
That's right.
That's pretty powerful, you know. That's saying, and by the way, that's not saying it's smoking your victim. That's saying that they're, you know, your killers. They're guilty of negligent homicide. So that is quite powerful stuff. But when it comes right down to it, I do wonder. I mean, people certainly have been convinced that they have a right not to be exposed to this stuff, and that there is some element of health risk involved. But it still seems to me that when you're encountering it, the remote tiny risk of lung cancer is not the main thing on your mind. The main thing on your mind is I want to get rid of this. And the health concern is a way of legitimizing that complaint and saying, not only is this a desire of mine, this is a right.
I agree with what Jacob was saying. I got to sit in on several public policy meetings in Los Gatos in California. And just from what I was able to see, the people who were already opposed to smoking prior to the idea that secondhand smoke does anything latched onto the idea of, you know, you could be killing me. They were just delighted that they could be killed by this. This is the best. Ordinarily victims aren't quite so happy about these things, but they were very thrilled, and it allowed them to become even more shrill. But nobody was shocked and horrified when this study came out. They were delighted. It was glorious, and they could go up and wave it back and forth.
Do you have a question?
I agree.
This gentleman, and then it'll be. Would either of you care to comment on the CDC's 40-year sponsorship of the infamous Tuskegee study of untreated syphilis in black men who were used like guinea pigs?
I'm not that familiar with all I know is when I read the newspapers about that, really. I don't know in depth. I'm shocked to hear that the government would use citizens as guinea pigs.
we incidentally have another book, since I'm talking books tonight, called Cutting Green Tape, which deals in part with the so-called issue of toxic torts by government. And if you want to see real tort damages that for which government officials are essentially kept completely immune from liability, start looking into those areas. And of course, these agencies know this, and that's why the Army or others pursue these kinds of tests. Gentlemen, right here.
I'm sorry.
The guy with the mic gets to speak. I'll be very brief, and you make a comment on what I'm about to say. I happen to be in the life insurance business, and we have people who are called actuaries, and they study rates of death, and they do this for a living, and they have to be very, very accurate because they're projecting out many years in the future, and hundreds of millions and billions of dollars are riding on this. And I can tell you that if I take an application and write an application for anybody for a life insurance policy, and that person tells me he or she smokes, right there I know that the rate is going to be at least 20% higher, because the actuaries have already determined that the probability of that person dying is greater. So that's pretty much. But the second thing I'd like to say is that I can then write an insurance policy on that person's spouse who lives with them. And if he or she says, no, I don't smoke, there are no consequences. The actuaries have not imputed one single dime into the premium for the person who lives with them.
Do you want to comment on?
Well, I mean, it just, that reflects, you know, both the weakness of the evidence and the very small magnitude of the risk they're talking about. I mean, in the EPA report, we're talking about a risk that you take a very tiny risk and you raise it by 19%, it's still really tiny, you know? And the risk of lung cancer in non-smokers is very, very small. So if you take that risk and you raise it by 20%, or even if you raise it by 100%, it's still really small. So in practical terms, it doesn't amount to much, even if we assume that what the EPA says is valid.
The other gentleman.
Yeah, I have to confess that years ago I graduated from a school of public health, but I was rational enough to leave the field about 20 years ago when they gave up science. However, I still get the periodical publications from the school, you know, where they're bragging on their current research and, of course, begging for funds. And the thing in the latest journal, I don't know if they're bragging on their program on social epidemiology. I don't know if you've heard that one. But I read the article on it, and it turns out that they discovered that poor people don't have as good a state of health as rich people do, which we knew 50 years ago. But their cure for it now, as economists, you'll love this. The reason that poor is to get rid of poverty, which is now a public health problem. And the reason that poor people are poor, of course, is because rich people are rich. There's only so much wealth to go around, and if rich people... and the bottom line is that it's a public health responsibility of the wealthy, then, to pay for the health care of the poor. Because, could a comment on that?
Well, we addressed that in our book, actually. I wrote about it in the context of a psychiatrist in Washington, D.C., who I've talked with a few times. Sally Satel is her name, and she went to the annual meeting of the American Public Health Association, and the keynote speaker was Jesse Jackson, and then the next day's luncheon speaker was John Sweeney, the head of the AFL-CIO. And it was one big political rally, and she said there was almost no talk of health, science. It was all, how can we get Jesse Jackson's political agenda through? That was pretty much what they talked about. And she wrote about this in the Wall Street Journal, and she had a blizzard of letters from these characters that the journal published criticizing her. And pretty much what they said was just what you said: poor people have worse health than affluent people. We've known that for a lot longer than 50 years, I would think. But their solution is a bigger welfare state. And she argued, no, well, no, that's not the solution. Look at what we've done. You know, we've perpetuated poverty. And so we take that whole issue on in our book about how we agree with them. Poor people do have less healthy lives. But it's more capitalism they need, not more socialism. But the American Public Health Association promotes socialism, not just healthcare socialism, but just socialism in general. Higher taxes, more regulation, more redistribution of wealth. And so they'll harm poor people. There'll be less wealth for the poor. Right. And it's sort of a vulgarized Marxian economics, the idea that I'm rich because you're poor because I'm rich. That's but they're mired in sort of 1920s era socialist thinking.
Just as long as I got the mic, one other question. Do you think the public is anywhere near aware that our current public health policies are not based on science?
Probably not. Most of the public is what economists call rationally ignorant about these things.
I think, though, that you've provided the missing link that explains why there was this article on gambling in the American Journal of Public Health. When I came across that, it puzzled me, but clearly it's because if you gamble and you lose, you become poor, and then you're not healthy anymore.
You already had one question, but this will be the final question.
I'm rich.
I'd be interested to know from both speakers any examples that they have of where the government regulations restrict your personal responsibility that you are grateful for. And if there are any such, how do you discriminate between when Nanny is useful and when she's not?
I'm hard pressed to think of any. But that is a problem that if people have come to accept, for example, the seatbelt law or the tax on cigarettes or restrictions on advertising alcoholic beverages or what have you, that those things can always be cited as precedents and are. Well, we have this and we've had it for a long time and nobody really condemns that, so why not? And that is a problem because, you know, if you're gonna be consistent about it, you have all these conservatives railing against you know, the anti-smoking movement, but most of them are very gung-ho about the war on drugs, and I don't see the distinction there. You know, I mean, you know, they're talking about targeting one drug versus another. They don't like the fact that tobacco is targeted because they're used to tobacco. They know people who smoke. You know, they're conservative, so they like what they're used to. But you know, in terms of health effects, certainly it's worse than any illegal drug that you can name. You know, not necessarily in terms of short-term intoxication, but health effects.
So what regulations are you grateful for?
Yeah, I can't think of any. That's what I mean. If you're talking about,
well, suppose
you're talking
that
about regulations,
were required to take a driver's license to run a car.
Well, you originally
gross infringement on personal responsibility.
No, well, I mean, your initial question had to do with denying personal responsibility. Is that right?
Yeah, any
regulation that, in some sense, infringes on the personal responsibility.
Well, if you're talking about regulations that try to protect people from themselves, then I'm hard-pressed to think of any examples that I approve of. If you're talking about regulations that try to protect you from other people, there are a lot that I would approve of, a lot of laws that aim to protect you from other people's.
So that's your discrimination.
Yeah, well, I mean, if it's something that is a threat to other people, there's a clear distinction, and you have to talk.
Well, it's often hard to distinguish.
Well, you have to talk more precisely about the nature of the threat, what constitutes a violation of somebody's rights, in terms of rules of the road and things like that. Somebody has to set the rules. The owner of the road is going to do it. In this case, it happens to be the government.
Right.
If you had a private owner, they might very well have a different speed limit or different technical rules about whether you can turn right on red or whatever, and a lot of that is very arbitrary. But there's got to be some rules, and the owner of the road is going to set them.
A lot of it depends on whether you have a system based on contract or one group imposes order on other people. And that's sort of the classic debate going back to the Greeks. And so the question is, how does that relate to public health?
Well, for a lot of these regulations, the first thing I always think of is if we didn't have this regulation, and there is a real problem, how might it be dealt with alternatively? And we tend to think that, for example, if the government had always manufactured shoes, monopolized the shoe industry, people would be saying, who would make the shoes if we privatize the shoe industry? We've never had private shoes. No one will make shoes. But if the government has been doing it for a long, long time, we tend to think there's no other way of doing it, of securing safety in various ways. And so I always think of what private institutions or contracts would come up that would protect us. Zoning. Bernard Sagan wrote a book 25, 30 years ago called Land Use Without Zoning. Everyone thought you needed zoning to protect yourself from nuisances in your neighborhoods. And he found out that Houston, where there was no zoning at all, had pretty much the same protections through private covenants that all the other cities had in America. But they did it voluntarily. And that's the way I would think about these things. What alternative means are there to improve safety? Not always what is the specific benefit. That's what's seen, the benefit of the government regulation. What you don't see is what might have happened under an alternative regime.
Okay, I want to cut it off there, I'm afraid. I want to thank our speakers in particular for their wonderful comments and for their books. And I want to thank all of you. Thank all of you for joining with us. Again, if you haven't gotten copies of either of the books, there are copies upstairs. And I'm sure that either author would be happy to autograph any copies you might get. And we hope that you'll join us for our next Independent Policy Forum. Thank you and good night. The talks tonight will be transcribed, and you can purchase copies of that, or audio tapes, or videotapes.